Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Jim Potts back on the air. Thanks for sharing your Sunday with me. As always, I really do appreciate it. Hey, tonight we're going to finish up this part on why kids kill. We're going to do part three. And as you know, I normally do emails. We're also going to be talking about some female shooters and some other things. But before we do that, I just want to send a shout out to the families and survivors of the Harvest Festival before I forget. October 1st marked the anniversary, the one-year anniversary. A tragic event, of course, and the worst mass shootings in history. So for those family members, our hearts are with you. Survivors, our hearts are with you. And for those of you who did survive especially, we hope that as best as you can that you've moved on, and if not, that you're getting the help that you need to help you hopefully forget this tragic event. All right, listen, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to turn things around a little bit right now because I do want to finish up on this piece about why kids kill. So I'm going to do my emails. We're going to be talking about female shooters as well. But I want to get into this part first so make sure we can get it out of the way, so to speak. Just to recap, you know, we've talked about in the past 2 weeks, we've talked about the fact that Peter Langman, who's a PhD, is the one who I've gotten my research material from. So I always like to give that little disclaimer, you know, because I'm not the guy that's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, so therefore I want to give credit where credit is due with this. And for those that didn't listen to the previous two shows, I just want you to understand that there's a lot of information out there on why these kids kill. Bullying is a misconception prompted by the media and people that have not really looked at the long-term research on why these individuals do what they do. So at any rate, go back, listen to the other two shows if you're just tuning in for the first time on this episode, this topic rather. As I promised last week, this week we're going to be talking about the Columbine shooters. And the reason why we're going to do that is because of the fact that everybody remembers Columbine. We may not remember some of the other places where these events have taken place. People always remember Columbine. And the two shooters there, as I mentioned before, were Eric Harris and Dylan Klybold. They're the ones that carried out this rampage attack at Columbine High School, which is located, by the way, for those of you who do not know, Jefferson County in Colorado. These two guys killed 13 people, wounded 23, and then killed themselves. And you have to look into the minds of these individuals, why they did what they did. And that's kind of what we're going to explore today based on the research by Dr. Langman and a couple of other individuals. Now, let's take Eric Harris first, because he was the main one. And there's two contradictory views about him. And one was that he was an ostracized, lonely boy who was tormented by his peers, you know, and that he acted in sort of in retaliatory violence of sorts. But there's an alternative view, is that he was essentially an evil monster. And, you know, you look at this and say, it's a label, but it's not an explanation. Okay, he was a monster. He did this. It's not an explanation, though. And to understand this individual, because he was the main perpetrator behind this, we got to go beyond the labels and the internal workings of his mind. And when we do so, we find out that there's two views. Was he a mistreated loner and an evil monster? That's not good enough. It has to go deeper than that. Now, I will tell you that Eric was not a loner. He had lived in Colorado through middle school and high school, had multiple groups of friends, and engaged in a wide variety of activities with his peers. He lived a highly social life and was liked by both boys and girls. And even on April 9th, 1999, just 11 days before the attack, a group of his friends took him out to dinner to celebrate his 18th birthday. So you have to wonder, you know, was he ever teased? Well, yeah, he was teased in all honesty, but guess what? They said at Columbine High School, there was a lot of that went on. So it wasn't an unusual situation. And we know that kids tease each other. There's millions of kids that get teased in schools. And I guess maybe that's just part of the growing up process. But all of them don't turn around and turn into killers. His mother, there was many other kids at Columbine that didn't do it. And bullying, well, look, that's there. But that's not the primary reason why Eric did what he did. Now, he may have claimed to be retaliating against people who mistreated him. And when you look at it and you do the research on it, this explanation is problematic, and I'll tell you why. First, he had planned to blow up the school, killing people regardless of whether they had victimized him or not. So if you're looking for somebody to get even with, you don't blow up everybody. Second, he actually made a hit list of students from the class of 1998 who, quote unquote, deserved to die. So they had all this information when they actually searched his things. Now, keep in mind, he did not commit the attack in 1998. By the time he did carry out the attack, no one on the list was still there. They had already graduated. Finally, as he shot students in the school's library, Eric told that this was retaliation for everything they had done to him. The truth, however, is that he was gunning down students who had never done anything to him. So his claim of vengeance was a rationalization. That's all that it was. That's all that it was. And the attack on Columbine High School was not intended simply a school shooting, but rather a large-scale bombing. And Eric, along with Dylan, set bombs in the cafeteria that were actually timed to go off at a peak lunch hour. And if those bombs had detonated, it was estimated they would have killed all 660 people in the cafeteria. Think about that. These young guys, this is what they planned. And the next stage of the attack was either to shoot people as they fled the building or to enter the building and shoot whomever they found alive. This sort of thinking has nothing to do with having been bullied to this degree. This is ridiculous to even think that it had anything to do with bullying, not with the relationships that he generally had with people. And let me just tell you something else. Eric and Dylan, they had bombs in their cars that were going to go off after parents, the media, law enforcement officials, and rescue workers had arrived, potentially killing hundreds more. What did they have to do with him being bullied? Absolutely nothing. These plans were far beyond anything that had to do with getting even with anybody. Just look at the facts that the media never exposed us to. If you just go back in time, you will see that everything that they pointed out at that time was bullying, bullying, bullying. And that's why, especially for the first-time listeners to this particular segment, where we talked about the fact that the media has a tendency to give you the initial knee-jerk reaction because that's the news at the time. But they don't go back after the in-depth studies have been done to find out why people like this do the things that they do. Now, contrary to the initial reports, the attack was not targeted toward jocks, because when this first came out, they said it was, for those of you who don't know what jocks are, those are athletes. and also Christians, minorities, or any particular individual group. The attack they planned would have killed a massive number of people. There were no specific targets. If there's no specific target, you can't say that it was motivated by revenge or that somebody had bullied them. Even Eric and Dylan's friends would have been victims. Those would have been possibly the same people that took them out to dinner. It didn't matter to these guys. They had planned an indiscriminate attack against the school and everyone in it, not to mention the first responders, the media, as well as even parents who were coming up there in search of their loved ones. Now, I want to tell you, on the day of the attack, Eric actually wore a shirt that read Natural Selection. His shirt didn't say death to jocks or I hate school or even revenge. It said natural selection. This was his message to the world regarding the attack. And he was fascinated. Believe it or not, this young kid at 13 was fascinated by the Nazis' efforts to eliminate inferior people. He said in class even that anyone who was not fit for life deserves to die. He declared, "I will kill whoever I deem unfit." Listen to that. 13 years old, he's making a determination who he will kill because he thinks they're unfit. Does that sound like somebody normal to you? Does that sound like somebody that was upset with bullying? He wrote in his journal, natural selection, kill all retards. People with brains, retarded brains. And he also wrote things, I don't want to put it, I can't even say it on the air, but he used the word F-ups as well. All right? Use your imagination on that. People spend millions of dollars on saving the lives of retards. And why, he said, I don't buy that, I'll just use another word, crap, like, oh, he's my son, though, so, you know, what the heck? I'm using that instead of another word that he used. It ain't normal. Kill him. Put him out of his misery. He is only a waste of time and money. This is a 13-year-old in his journal saying these things. Once again, this had nothing to do with bullying. So if you want to say that this guy was psychotic, which is what we started talking about last week, that's exactly what this guy sounds like he was. You know, he was a psychopath. Now, for those that are out there, let's just talk about what psychopaths are, because I want to make sure that I'm clear on that. Psychopathic shooters as a group, first, the word group may be misleading. I have to tell you that, because out of the 10 shooters I told you about earlier in one of the other segments, only two were really psychopathic. And now this is important, because people often label all school shooters as psychopathic. And that, I'm going to tell you, it's an inaccurate statement. Most school shooters do not fit the diagnosis of psychopaths. Now, you remember I talked to you about the 11-year-old? His name was Drew Golden, 11 years old. Remember him? Well, stop and think for a moment how alike Drew and Eric may have been. Both of them were sadistic. Eric fantasized about raping girls and mutilating people's bodies. Does that sound normal to you? At 13? Also, his behavior during the attack was remarkable for his taunting of his victims, as well as his glee in having power over people. Drew, the 11 years old, his sadism I talked to you about, was clearly expressed in his torturing and killing of cats. Remember that? They both had anger management problems, Eric and Drew. Mr. and Mrs. Harris, as Eric's parents, noted their son's explosive outbursts. Eric's rage is also evident throughout his journal. This kid kept the journal, and in the testimony of his classmate. Drew, on the other hand, his anger was evident in his threatening and intimidating behavior with his peers. Now, kids think, you know, some kids out there think guns are cool, but Eric and Drew had an unusual fascination with weapons. I mean, that was very well known. I think I told you with Drew had his first gun at 11 years old. Excuse me, at 6 years old, actually. He was 11. He had his first gun at 6 years old. Who gives a 6-year-old a gun? A BB gun? Okay. Toy gun? Okay, I get those. I think I had those when I was younger like that. But a real gun? No. No way. You have to wonder whether or not the parents fostered this somehow, to be perfectly honest with you. Well, look, that's discussing psychopaths. But the other part that I wanted to get into was whether or not he was psychotic. Because as I told you originally on the show, you have psychopaths and you have psychotics. Now, I just told you about what psychopaths are, so let's talk about psychotics and see how they fit into that. The term psychotic in a general sense refers to being out of touch with reality. Does Eric sound like he was out of touch with reality? The two primary ways that people can be psychotic, they have hallucinations and delusions. That's what they do. Now, psychotic symptoms are not necessarily constant or debilitating. One tragic aspect of the psychotic shooters, in fact, was their ability to cover up their psychotic symptoms so that no adults were aware of what they were going through. And by hiding their psychosis, the shooters did not receive the treatment that could have allowed them to maintain safe behavior. Now, as what I found interesting was that Eric, in fact, kept a journal. Apparently, his parents never saw the journal, never read the journal, or if they saw it, they never paid attention to it. People write diaries. Look, parents, you've heard me say this before. We've got to know what our children are doing. Does that make you a snoop these days? Heck yeah. You can learn a whole lot of information. I told you about the 14-year-old girl. in Orange County, California, whose father suspected that she was up to something, something wasn't right, checked her computer, and she come to find out she had been online and she was planning something more horrific than Columbine. And somehow or another, she had gotten some weapons and other things, and she was going to go to her school and do some serious damage. That was a parent that was being proactive. Not too long ago, the chief of police, or a captain, for the Boston Police Department reported his own son because his son had started doing some things that he thought were odd. Now, his son was over 20 years of age, but he turned around and reported him, and the son ended up pleading guilty and is now heading to prison because of some of his beliefs about ISIS and things that he had planned. But this, again, this is parents trying to be proactive. Who wants to be the parent of a killer like this? I couldn't even imagine that with any of my sons. Would never even conceive it. But if you see it, you've got to react to it. You've got to do something. This behavior is just simply out of the ordinary. And as parents, we have an obligation not only to our family, but to society in general. Now, Eric Harris had a partner at Columbine. And you don't hear as much about him because he was kind of in the shadow, so to speak, but yet he was one of the principal shooters. Now, his name was Dylan Kleibold. Dylan came from a family with an intact marriage and had no known violence or abuse of any kind. By all accounts, Dylan was a shy, insecure child, but one who was described as the sweetest, cutest kid you'd ever meet. I'm sure that's a definition by his parents, because let's face it, we all see our kids that way. So when you think about it, how do we make any sense out of what Dylan did? Why did Dylan engage in the behavior that he did? Well, in reviewing all the illegal acts that Dylan committed, it might make sense to think that he, like Eric, was a psychopath. After all, Dylan committed the same terrorist act as Eric. And I will tell you that Dylan was arrested with Eric for breaking into a van and stealing equipment. Dylan was also involved in hacking into the school's computer system to find locker combinations of students he did not like. He was suspended for this, and he was also caught defacing a student's locker. Okay, some of that stuff is just a bunch of high school stuff, in my opinion. Dylan stole computer equipment from schools and engaged in vandalism with Eric. Notice this, Eric. Now, being a psychopath involves deception and impressionment management. If Dylan was on the same path as Eric, but people were more surprised by Dylan's involvement in the attack, did that mean that he was better at impression management? That he was a more deceptive psychopath than Eric? Well, I don't know at this point. They're both gone. We can only rely on their acts. We can only rely on journals that were found. And by the way, they both kept journals. Dylan was the shadow of Eric. So what Eric did, Dylan did. Now, they offer another possibility is that Dylan was a psychotic. So remember I talked about Eric being a psychopath. Well, Dylan, they think, was psychotic. In looking at his journal, they found at one point where he said, "When I'm in my human form, knowing I'm going to die, everything has a touch of reality or triviality to it. When I'm in my human form," was he not always in a uniform, in a human form, guys? Of course. And he's thinking that sometimes he's not in his human form. Does that sound like somebody, in your opinion, is psychotic? I mean, what did he even mean by that? He referred to himself as being godlike. And again, these guys are all early teens. Godlike? What did that have to do with being bullied? Nothing. In other quotes, he referred to himself as being godlike, as I told you. And then Eric also liked to write, "I am God." And he wrote it in German. He was all too aware of the fact that he was not a godlike being. Dylan's quote sounded as if he believed that he had attained godhood. This is not normal, folks. Maybe it was just a joke between Dylan and Eric. Who knows? It could have just been a way that they like to talk to each other, but who knows? Now, this happened in 1999. His journal was not even released to the public until 2006. Now, prior to that, there would have been no way to get an internal view of him. His journal, when they finally opened it up to the public, gave us a window into the aspects of Dylan that would otherwise have remained unknown. So these journals are good. Parents, when your kids are in school, check out those journals. Because I'm going to tell you something, without access to his writings, we basically would have missed so much of his personality, his struggles, and his preoccupation. Do parents get involved in kids' struggles? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. The parents that care, do. And those who don't, don't. We have an obligation. We bring these kids into the world. We have an obligation, in my opinion. And you know, like I know, for you, those of you that have kids now that are adults, come on. The reality is they are still our kids no matter how old they are or how old we get. That's just a fact of life. Now, I will tell you that Dylan's journal was different from Eric's in both content and style. Now, I will tell you, because Eric's journal was full of narcissistic condensations and bloodthirsty rage, Dylan, his was different. His was focused on loneliness, depression, and preoccupation with finding love. Eric drew pictures of weapons, swastikas, and soldiers. Dylan, he drew hearts. Eric lusted after sex and fantasized about rape. Dylan, the only thing he wanted was true love. Look at the difference in these two guys. Why were they so different, and yet they committed the same act? Eric Harris influenced Dylan, is what the researchers say. Dylan just longed for love. That's a lot different from Eric. Statistically speaking, the two journals were also different. Eric's writing is clear, and Dylan's is vague, dreamy, fragmented, and strange. Eric's writing articulately expresses his rage, hatred, contempt, bigotry, and desire to destroy humanity. This kid is 13. I can't help but repeat that. Dylan's writing is jumbled, disorganized, and full of tangled syntax and misused words. Eric's words are truly disturbing. For a 13-year-old, Dylan's thought process is disturbed. The difference is what Eric thinks and how Dylan thinks. That's the difference between the two. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Dylan experienced an ongoing struggle regarding friendships and female companionship. Now, remember I told you about Eric. He was the life of the party. People taking him out to celebrate his 18th birthday, etc. Dylan was different. And I have to tell you, he was painfully aware of his social difficulties. He wrote about the routine of his life in a way where he said, go to school, be scared and nervous, hoping that people can accept me. He really longed for acceptance, but he felt he never really achieved it. Nobody accepted me, even though I want to be accepted. Me looking weird and acting shy. Big problem, he wrote in his journal. See the difference in these two? Now look, we've all been through that teenage process. It's not unusual. This is not unusual, and it's common that teenagers worry about being liked. But Dylan's social anxiety was extreme. He wrote, I see how different I am. Yet, I'm on such a greater scale of difference than anyone else. So, his loneliness and sense of inadequacy resulted in severe depression and suicidal thoughts, issues he discusses repeatedly in his journal. In one entry, he wrote, I am in internal suffering, in infinite direction, in infinite realities. Another entry, oh God, I want to die so bad. Such a sad, desolate, lonely, unsalvageable, I feel I am. Not fair, not fair. Let's sum up my life. The most miserable existence in the history of time. Think about that. How in the world did his parents miss this? Because once again, he hid this. He hid it. He never expressed it openly. He kept it all to himself. This is why we have to sit down and talk to our parents. You know, as we move through life and technology, we move through with technology, think about something. Think about now how these kids are sitting down either at their computers, their iPads, their iPods, all of these gaming toys that they're with. My wife and I were at the airport one time, and we were looking around. And in one particular place we saw, and I even talked to my older brother Charles about this, where he had seen the same thing. Yeah, at an airport, here's a family of four. The father was on his phone texting. The mother was on her phone texting. And they're the two kids, a boy and a girl. They were on their whatever they were, their gizmos, I'll call them. I don't think that they were phone. It looked like gaming or something of that nature. They're not even talking to each other. When I was raised, we had dinner every night. We were all down there together. My mother would like literally ring the dinner bell, and we'd all be coming down there. We'd all be in the kitchen eating together. We had a pretty big kitchen. Or we were all at the dining room table, and we talked. Those days look like they're gone. Parents have got to push these kids away from some of this stuff, in my opinion, and talk to your children. And that's the sad part about it is we're becoming detached from them. Now, it's perhaps significant that Dylan's journal includes suicidal statements prior to the summer of 1997, but there's no homicidal comments until the fall of that year. And by that time, Dylan may have attached himself to Eric and adopted Eric's homicidal ideas as his own. So think about it. His journal started before he met Eric. Dylan did not have to write about being God until after the friendship crises. Perhaps he was influenced by Eric's grandiosity. Dylan's involvement with Eric raises an important question. How could Dylan, whose family was part Jewish and who participated in Jewish holidays, affiliate with someone who embraced Nazism? Are you kidding me? Eric and Dylan gave Nazi salutes when they got strikes in bowling. They would shout either Sieg Heil or Heil Hitler. The publicity salute, they did this in public. And when they did this, Hitler is simply bizarre for someone from a family where the mother identifies herself as being Jewish. Dylan gave up his identity when he started associating with Eric. Now think about that. What kind of person gives up his or her identity to become like somebody else? How did they end up as a team? Well, the old thing about opposite attracts doesn't just apply to marriage. These guys were the opposites, and they were attracted to each other. Now I will tell you, although Dylan participated in the murderous rampage, several witnesses testified that he had a subordinate position during the attack. One student reported that Eric was telling Dylan where to shoot. Another student noted that not only was Eric ordering Dylan around, but Dylan was trying to impress Eric. These observations support the idea that Dylan was essentially acting out Eric's wishes. He ended up being a follower, is the bottom line. Sad, but true. He came from a decent household, and unfortunately, this is where he ended up. Dylan was an enigma. If he had been living three different lives with Eric. Dylan was the spineless psychopath, acting tough, engaging in vandalism and other crimes, and planning a murderous assault. By himself, writing in his journal, he was schizophrenic, lost in fantasies, confused, lonely, despondent, self-deprecating, and yet evaluating himself to godhood. With his parents and others, he often seemed like a typical high school kid. Maybe a little different or goofy, but going about the activities that normal kids engage in. He did socialize, by the way. Went bowling, attended class, and even had a couple of part-time jobs. All the usual activity of teenagers. Apparently, no one had any inkling of his world inside. Sad, but true. Parents, you've got to get on it. Dylan's ability to disclose his suffering and his psychotic symptom is one of the saddest aspects of Columbine. He could have gotten help if only he had opened up about what was happening inside him. Unfortunately, he was not the only psychotic shooter who failed to communicate his dire psychological distress. Parents, you've got to pay attention. You've got to understand that these kids, as they're coming along, they go through things just like you may have. Talk to them. Sit down with them. Find out what's going on. Don't let them shut you out. And if you suspect anything, hey, it doesn't hurt to do a little snooping. I'm going to end my segment on why kids kill. I gave you 3 weeks of this. Anybody that has any questions or comments, I always welcome. You can always give me a call to 818-602-4929, or you can email me at listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. I always appreciate hearing from people. Okay, with that, let's move on. Let's talk about some emails that I receive. Here we go. This first one, Jim, I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and recently a law is going to be passed taking away guns from anyone involved in domestic violence. Do you think that's fair, Joe? Well, Joe, you're absolutely right. The Pennsylvania lawmakers passed the first anti-violence legislation in more than a decade that deals directly with firearms. And this has been an issue out there for years. And basically, I will tell you that it's the violence prevention groups that persuaded the legislator to protect, for the protection of gun rights who got into this. And it's what it is that bill is going to force people in Pennsylvania with a domestic violence ruling against them to more quickly surrender their guns. Now, advocates who pushed this out there in Pennsylvania said that the Parkland, Florida high school shooting that killed 17 people and with the MT movement helped to propel this legislation. Now, I will also tell you that they've got a Republican-controlled Senate out there who voted 43-5 to send the bill to the desk of the Democratic governor, who's Tom Wolf. Tom Wolf plans on signing that. Now, there's 29, I've done some research on this, Joe. There's 29 other states that already have laws in place regarding domestic violence and taking guns away from people involved in domestic violence. Now, you know, we've done segment and shows on the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, et cetera. And we had a lot of good callers in on that. But now we're talking about taking guns away from people that have been convicted of domestic violence. So do I think it's fair? Well, look, I think that with certain convictions, when you get convicted, that you do give up certain rights. And I think there has to be certain controls in place. And as a police officer, I can tell you that I had responded to situations where there's domestic violence, there's threats of domestic violence, with guns. But they're just talking about guns. Unfortunately, with domestic violence situations, it doesn't just have to be with guns. It could be with other things. People have used knives. People have bludgeoned. People have run each other over. I mean, there's been a lot with it. So to me, this is just one aspect of it. But when you get convicted, yes, you give up certain rights. So I think that this is not a bad thing. I don't think it's a violation of the Second Amendment. Hey, anybody's got any opinions about it, you're certainly welcome to call me and discuss it at 818-602-4929. But I do believe that law is not, totally a bad law. And I don't think that it necessarily gives up the Second Amendment right that we have. That was written with the understanding that people were going to be, quote unquote, law abiding with it. You know, when you get convicted of a crime, it's like when you go to jail, because you've done time in prison, there's certain rights that you lose. And when you step outside of the guidelines of the law, I think that there have to be laws in place that, in fact, we have to abide by, because without laws, we're nowhere as a nation. You know, Texas, I'm going to tell you, this issue, even in Texas, they require people convicted of domestic violence to turn in their firearms and prohibit all people under domestic violence restraining order from having firearms as well. Now, think about that. Texas, that's a gun-toting state. But they have it. So it's for a reason. It's for a reason. Because these restraining orders, they've got to be able to do that. If that situation has reached a level where you got to issue restraining orders to keep two people or keep one person away from another person or keep two people apart, then I just don't think that that's a bad thing. So I look at it like the people who are affected by this law are not law-abiding citizens. If they were law-abiding citizens, they would not be in that situation. Domestic violence in this country is a big issue. You've heard me talk about that before. It spills over into the work environment. That's how you end up with active shooters in the work environment sometimes because of domestic violence situations. So, yeah. Joe, I appreciate you writing in. Do you think it's fair? To answer your question, JoJo, I think it's fair. Okay, next one. Jim, I'm curious about your opinion whether you feel Brett Kavanaugh will keep the Second Amendment in place. Pete from Kentucky. Pete, one of the things that I always say is that I don't get into taking sides with all the stuff that's been going on in politics. I really am trying to maintain a neutral attitude. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do, but I will say this. There's nine people that sit on the Supreme Court, and it takes at least a majority of those individuals. So I don't look at any one justice from that standpoint to be making any of the decisions. Whether it happens, doesn't happen, et cetera, only time will tell. But I read this email because I wanted to make sure, because I know this is a big issue for people about his appointment, but I stay neutral with it. There's no crystal ball. Don't know what's going to happen one way or another. All right? So I wish I could answer that a little bit better for you, but that's the deal. Jim, last week you sent a shout-out to families of slain officers, of two slain officers. Now this week, seven officers were shot, and one of those was killed. Is there a war on cops going on out there? No. I wouldn't want to call it a war on cops. I think it's sad when this stuff happens. You're talking seven officers shot, one fatally. From what I understand, I think two more are still in critical. This actually happened in Columbia, South Carolina. And, you know, the suspect has been taken into custody, and I think that's a good thing. And taking a closer look at it, the shooting began when the sheriff's deputies were attempting to serve a search warrant at his house. And he turned around and opened fire. Now, let me tell you something. Going to houses on search warrants, domestic violence call-ins and things, those, believe it or not, are the most dangerous situations for police officers. I can tell you that. That's why if they were going there to serve a warrant, whatever the case may be, I'm sure more than one went there at the same time because these situations are considered the most dangerous situations when they're responding to domestic violence situation or serving warrants on individuals. Now, when we look at these situations, it actually took place in Florence, but the news came out of Columbia. Now, the police officers, you've heard me say it before, they've got it tough out there, there's no doubt about it. But they just had a Chicago police officer who was just convicted of shooting, I think it was a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old. And those facts are absolutely ridiculous. So you hear me talking about police officers and, you know, I'm all behind them, you know that. But police officers who do things that don't make sense, in my opinion, well, they got to pay the price like everybody else. They're not above the law. And I don't know if you heard on the news this week, but a Chicago police officer who had shot and killed a 14-year-old. Now, he had a knife, but he was walking away. He was walking away from this police officer. And the police officer shoots him 16 times. Now, let me just tell you something. 16 times? I'm not sure he had a gun that held 16 shots. That means dropping a clip out, putting another clip in, and shooting eight more times. I mean, this is ridiculous. So now he's been convicted of second-degree murder. Not first-degree murder, but second-degree murder. first degree murder is premeditation, or it happens during the death occurs during the commission of an inherently dangerous felony. But second degree murder is something that happens when it's an unreasonable situation. This was unreasonable, and the jury found him guilty. That doesn't bring back a 14-year-old boy's life. This police officer is obviously going to jail. He's going to be sentenced. But look how he changed not only the lives around that 14-year-old, but he changed the lives also of even his own family. Police officers do have to be responsible when they're out there. So I don't disagree with that at all. And he used bad judgment. And unfortunately, we have a death that's occurred. So I don't think there's a war on police officers, to answer your question, but that's what it is. I'm sorry, that was from Alice. I got another email. Jim, can illegal aliens who kill be considered terrorists? No, in my opinion. Remember what I've said in the past. If you're a regular listener, that's not what a terrorist is. Terrorism are people who intentionally try to create fear. They try to instill their own ideological beliefs on others, like the ISIS or the Al-Qaeda's and things of that nature. And you have to kill like three or more. A lot of these illegal aliens, some people call them immigrants, whatever terminology you choose to use out there. These are individuals that are doing individual things, in my opinion. No, do I consider them to be terrorists? No. These individuals make mistakes just like everybody else. So let me just say that. You know, I know the argument with the media is always the fact that they're here illegally. If they weren't here illegally, this wouldn't have happened. Look, there's enough of this that goes on in this country, whether the person's illegal, not illegal, whatever the case may be. It's once again, it's the media that hypes some of this up, because that's the political thing to do these days, you know, to talk about this. Now, I don't care whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right. People talk about these kinds of issues. And no, I don't believe that because somebody dies at the hand of an illegal immigrant that they're a terrorist. They're not a terrorist. They're a killer. They're a murderer, depending upon the circumstances. Like the young guy that killed the female jogger a couple of months ago. I look at him and say he's just an outright murderer. It has nothing to do with him being a terrorist. He's just a murderer, which to me is a little is different. So Tom wrote this email to me. No, I don't believe that they are in fact terrorists. Okay, let's talk about female shooters. Because a couple of weeks ago, I got something that somebody had asked me about with these active shooters and females. Now, I'm going to tell you guys something, and this is information you probably are not even going to be aware of, but here we go again. With you got to pay attention to what's going on. Believe it or not, there's been 262 mass shootings in our country so far this year, and that is a horrifying number, folks. But yeah, there was a recent shooting with a female shooter, but I'm going to tell you something. Mass murder is typically profoundly males. It's a male act, not a female act. The numbers on female shooters, I got to tell you, are really drastically down. In general, women are far less homicidal than men. Women commit only about 10% to 13% of these homicides, according to the statistics. But when women do kill, they're less likely than men to choose firearms to do it. Yep, that's the bottom line. So guys, watch what she's putting in your drink when you're not looking. No, I'm just kidding. But they do use other ways to do it. Firearms is not typically what they do. But again, they're not above it. And I'm going to tell you something. You go to the gun range, you see more and more women out there at the gun range now. They're out there practicing. But they're there because really it's all about self-protection. But they're there. They're there. Now, I can tell you with some stats out there, only 8% of the female perpetrators with firearms or homicides, it's only 8% of women, 8%. But let me just tell you, 40%, by poisoning. Then they also have about 20% fire-related. They will burn you up. So watch your back, guys. They'll burn you up. So, yeah, there's different ways that they do it. So it's not beyond them, but they typically are not the ones when it comes to this mass shootings. Now, let me just tell you. There are actually 9 situations where the women were active shooter. Now, I will tell you that the first one was on April 1st. I say the first one. There's been women in history that have killed, okay? But I'm talking about more recently. So beginning in 2001, I'm talking about. April 23rd, 2001, Kathleen Raponte opened fire at the Laidlaw Transit Service Maintenance Yard in San Jose, California. She killed one person and she injured 3. Remember what I told you last week? What constitutes a shooter, an active shooter? 3 plus more are either killed or wounded. Here's another one for you. January 20th, 2006, former postal worker Jennifer San Marco carried a handgun into her previous place of employment at the Santa Barbara U.S. Postal Processing and Distribution Center in California and opened fire, killing 6 people before committing suicide. By the way, let me just tell you something. I'm not going to present it today, but I actually looked at what state has the more active shooters. Believe it or not, it's California. It's California. And think about it. We've got decent gun laws in place here. But California is at the top of the list. February 8th, 2008, 23-year-old Latina Williams began firing a handgun in a second-floor classroom at Louisiana Technical College, killing 2 people before turning the gun on herself. February 12th, 2010, 44-year-old Amy Bishop Anderson began shooting a handgun during a biology meeting at the University of Alabama, killing 3 and wounding 3 more. March 30th, 2010, Arunya Roche began firing her handgun in the parking lot of a public supermarket in Tarpon Springs, Florida, killing 1 person before police intercepted and apprehended her. September 6, 2010, Yvonne Hiller killed 2 people when she opened fire to co-workers in the Kraft Foods factory in Philadelphia before being apprehended later on. And let me tell you something, the numbers of workplace shooting, if you notice, these are workplace shootings, the majority of these. Workplace shootings. June 8th, 2014, Amanda Renee Miller walked into Cecil's Pizza in Las Vegas with her husband and opened fire on the crowd, killing 2 law enforcement officers having lunch at the time. The couple were gunned down by an armed citizen. Remember, Las Vegas. There's another one that's an open carry state. If you're going to do something, don't do it in Vegas or Texas. December 2nd, 2015. Now, this one I know you know. This has to do with Tafin Malik. She and her husband began shooting in the parking lot of the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino. They were killed hours later when they were fleeing to get away. And then most recently, Nassim Haggadam of San Diego found dead at the scene with what appeared to be a self-inflicted gun wound after shooting at YouTube's headquarters in San Bruno, California. Look at how many of these are in California, folks. And like I told you, those are the top 9 that had to do with women. So police officers, female shooters, there it is. Now, I want to tell you something. I ran into a gentleman. I was doing active shooter training within the last week up in Oakland, California. And a gentleman on the bus and I started talking. And we started talking about the active shooter piece and what happens in the work environment. And he actually gave me this little card that he and I are going to be discussing further. One side of the card has an active shooter event or hostile event, what to do. But on the back side of the card, he brings up that when there's any kind of trauma, you know, what to do. You know, I'm going to tell you something. To me, the work environment these days need to have a very good first aid kit. In addition to that, they also need to have, I'm getting a call. Let's see here. Hi, you're live on the air with Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. Do you have a question or comment to share? Hello? Nope. Okay. Nobody's there now. At any rate, so you need to have somebody in the work environment, in my opinion, that does CPR. Family members need to understand about people learning how to do CPR as well. So just think about those kind of things. Within the last minute, I want to send something out. I had one of my regular listeners, Jim from San Bernardino, you know, he sent me an email and said, I'd like to know your thoughts on designating, training, or deputizing, arming employees who work in corporate environments to prepare for an active shooter. Okay, I think they're trying again here. Let's see what we can do here. Hi, you're live on the air with Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. Do you have a question or comment to share?
Yes, Jim, I heard you talk about the fact that California has the most mass shootings. I just want to get your insight in regards to why you think that is. I mean, California is the most populous state, but then we also, California is really restrictive in regards to, you know, gun ownership and rights and stuff like that. So just want to get your insight in regards to that.
Yeah, that's amazing to me, to be perfectly honest with you. I was actually surprised by that because I know a lot of the counties, it's hard to even get a gun. I mean, LA County, as an example, forget about it. So why that is, I'm not really sure. I mean, we're a very large state. And if you notice on some of the examples that I gave, it's north and south in California. And the statistics that I had seen, for some reason, we're ahead of the pack in that. And I don't know whether it's the politics of the state where people at one point with these gun shows have more access to things. Because let's face it, you can go to gun shows and get things. If you don't have a prior record within 30 days, you know, you can get a handgun. Some of these other states might be a little bit more restrictive, but in the same token, you look at a state like Texas and Nevada, they weren't as high on the list. So maybe in those states, people recognize that if you shoot, I have the ability to shoot back. I don't know. But it's what I will do. I like your question. Let me do a little bit more research on that, because today all I did was give out the stat as a side note to something else that I was talking about. But I will try to look that up and try to discuss that next week. So if you tune in next week, maybe I'll have some more information for you. How's that sound? Hello? Okay, I think I lost my caller here. So at any rate, okay, you've been listening to Jim Potts at LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show. But let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. If you like what you heard, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, and be safe. Take care. Talk to you soon.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.